The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello, and welcome to MotoGPOD, the internet radio show about motorcycle road racing. Today is Friday, June 20th, 2008. This is episode number 133. I am Bob Hayes, your host, here today to bring you, as always, the best in MotoGP coverage and motorcycle road racing in general. Today, we've got a big show lined up. Had a great call with Jules. We talked about all sorts of stuff all over the map. A little bit of news, a little bit of Catalunya wrap-up, a little bit of gossip, just all kinds of stuff. So I think that we're going to pretty much let that call be the show, and we're going to get to that very, very, very shortly. Before we do that, I'd like to send a big shout-out thank you to Mickey Hamilton. Thank you very kindly for donating to the cause of MotoGPOD, helping to pay for the Skype bill, helping to pay for the bandwidth, the hosting, all that sort of stuff. This is Mickey's second donation, so that's a really, really cool thing. Do appreciate that. And let's see, other than that, most of the news that has come out here in MotoGP land, Jules and I have covered. So I think, why don't we go ahead and just get on with that call and not waste any more time. All right, we got Jules on the phone today. Been a while since we talked to Jules. How are you doing today, Jules?
I'm doing great, Bob. It's good to have you back on the show. I really enjoyed show 132.
Thanks very much. And I wanted to say thank you. I'm not sure if I mentioned this, a big shout out last time for taking over for those couple of shows so I could go off and do the Navy thing and then my track day and all that. And it was good stuff. Cool. So, all right. Let's see. I mean, basically, we all know what's coming up here. One of my favorite races of the season always is Donington. And we've got that coming up this weekend. So, other than the news that I missed last week, which I do have a valid reason, not an excuse, a reason. I recorded that whole show. I finished the whole show up a day earlier than I normally do. And the following morning, I get the news from Suzuki that says, Ben Spies is going to be at Donington. And it's like, crap. And I debated, you know, tacking it on to like the beginning of the show or trying to edit it in. I didn't have time. And so I just sort of ignored it. I got a lot of email about that one. Dude, you missed Ben Spies. Sorry. So that was my excuse, mea culpa for Donington. But that's one of the big announcements that we have going on about Donington is that Spies will be racing, taking place of the injured Loris Capirossi, who is going to be there in a sort of, you know, supporting spectator role. Yeah, support role. There you go. Yeah. That's the way to put
the
it.
The fatherly role. Mm-hmm. You know, he's actually going to miss Assen, too. So Ben Spies is likely to be racing in Assen as well.
Is he? Where'd you read that one? I missed that one.
Yep.
Did it come out from the Suzuki PR machine?
No. It's just that's the guy. Where did I get that? I saw that on CrashNet.
Okay. Yeah, a source you can always trust. But
Road Racing World, actually. Road Racing World had it. Sorry.
Oh, Road Racing World you can trust.
Yeah.
Crash.net is excellent for news that you have to take with a grain of salt.
Yep.
It's a bummer for Loris and stuff, but however, it's an excellent opportunity for Ben Spies. And let's face fact, Loris, if I'm not mistaken, is the oldest guy in the paddock now.
Yep, he is.
Grant, yeah, you got to go sometime or another, dude. And, you know, Loris actually probably has another season in MotoGP, I think. I'll go out on a limb on that one. But, you know, it's nice that Spies is getting this opportunity to shine, and it's going to make Spies' negotiations, if you want to say, with the various teams that his agent has been talking with that much better.
It's very interesting that he has been really pushing hard for this MotoGP ride. He's been offered a ride with World Superbike, and obviously I'm sure he gets a very nice salary with the AMA, but he just wants to go to GP. He just wants to race GPs, and I think that's great.
That's one of the sticking points, actually, is the size of his salary in AMA. And supposedly he has said that he's not going to work for less. And apparently he makes more than your average MotoGP rider in AMA.
Wow.
However, with all of our Daytona Motorsports group, which I keep threatening to sort of have a show about, but the whole thing is in such a giant state of flux, and I haven't really even been able to follow it very well.
Flux without the letter L, actually.
Yeah. It's just such a mishmash. But the latest word on the street, and this I got from Cycle News, so it's not actually the latest because it's, you know, it's a week old type of thing. If the rules stay as they were, like, well, almost a week and a half ago, as far as Daytona Motor Group is concerned, Suzuki's may not be doing a factory effort, and that's not spellbinding news. I mean, we've been sort of hearing rumors along this front for quite a while now. But if Suzuki takes off from AMA, that's not a good thing.
Well, I mean, it might just be, you know, making some noise to get the squeaky wheel oiled. But, you know, I don't know enough about the AMA, but what I do read about it just sounds insane.
Lately. You mean the latest stuff or in general?
Yeah, the latest stuff in general. No, just this next season, you know, and
yes.
This next series that they're building, it just sounds bizarre.
I agree. I don't want to get too far off on a sidetrack, but we probably should talk about it a little bit. And like I say, Darren and I are going to do a call about it. We've been planning and talking. We're going to do a little research.
Yeah, you guys should do it. Spare me because it's painful.
Okay. We'll save it for you. But it's just the one word I'm going to throw out there right now, NASCAR.
Yeah, and exactly.
I'm leaving it at that.
That's basically totally why like I just can't read that much about it. Every time I read about it, it just makes me ill.
Yes, it makes me a little disgruntled. I'm saving it for the future call. I'm not going to get sucked down this road.
All right,
so let's talk about Donington, Jules.
Well, actually, let's talk about a couple more things about Catalunya.
Okay.
There was because I was once again was able to watch after. I always watch the races live, no matter what time of the day they or night they are. And I watch I try to watch the 125s, 250s. I usually watch the beginning of 125s, wake up for the end of 250s, and then watch the GP race. And
I haven't been doing that so much this year, and I want to get back on track and join for the, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning internet chat, watch the race thing.
Exactly. And then my wife, who's a big fan of GP, the MotoGP around, usually is the one that like says, okay, let's watch the race again during the day. She also is up in the morning to watch it. And then so I've been able to get Eurosport from a friend of mine and watch those. And there's between the two broadcasts, I get a lot of extra information. It's kind of interesting combining the two. So some of the things I wanted to mention was certainly this stuff does not come out on speed because usually the best stuff happens during commercials. But No, because you know Neil Spaulding, who wrote this great MotoGP technology book, he's been appearing on Eurosport the last few broadcasts, and he puts in some really, really, really cool insights. They're very short usually, but they're very interesting. So one of the things he said during the race was that by the time they got to Jerez, Rossi's Yamaha team with the Bridgestones really started noticing that the rear tire on the Bridgestone tire starts to spin up the more it gets warmed up and the more it wears. It doesn't actually lose traction necessarily, but the quality of the traction, or maybe not the quantity, but the quality of the traction changes. And what they've been doing is Jeremy Burgess has been moving the weight of the bike back by moving the axles forward, both the front and rear axles forward on the Yamaha with every single race. And they've been able to finally get consistent grip for the entire race. And they've in doing that, they figured out that basically that's like the big secret that Ducati's been having that they have is, which is, it's not that big of a secret because if you listen to Melandri and if you listen to Ant West and everybody is complaining about rear wheel spin with Bridgestones, all the Bridgestone guys are complaining about the same thing. And so one of the things he said, so he basically said, you know, that Burgess and Rossi have basically figured out that the Yamaha, according to Spaulding, aside from the motor, is actually becoming much more like the Ducati. He even called it the Duhaka.
In Tuaca?
Or the Yamaki.
I think Yamakati would be better.
But. Yeah. So anyway, that was very interesting. He also was talking about the fact that the Honda pneumatic version of the motorcycle and the spring valve, they look exactly the same and they sound exactly the same.
I heard that, and I was a little surprised that there would be, you know, that you couldn't tell the difference, you know, especially a guy like Neil Spaulding or, you know, these guys that go to every race and they're technically minded and they, you know, they can tell this stuff, that they would sound exactly the same. I thought that was a little strange.
Yeah, and I think
because isn't it also you're going to raise the rev ceiling by like 1,000 at least, right?
Well, that's the whole point of the pneumatic engine, right?
So I mean, you'd think that you would hear. I mean, going from what 19 to 20,000 RPM is that's the range we're talking about?
Yeah, something like that. I think it's 18.5 to 19.5 or something like that. Whatever it is, it's I'm sure you'd notice if it was running at full, but that's the thing. It's like it's unknown whether Tadi Okada actually did push the engine all the way. Well, anyway, it just made me think, like, you know, I wonder, you know, whether they're going to introduce the bike, the motor, without the rest of the paddock even knowing that it's being raced. You know, who knows?
Do you think? Yeah, I wonder if they could get away with such a thing. I mean, not get away with as far as the rules is concerned, but how long would it take for the rest of the paddock to catch on?
Right.
Other than that, all of a sudden you've got more Hondas up in the top, you know, five.
I'm not sure what the point of it would be, really, to try and hide the fact that they're riding a bike because I mean, unless they were afraid that it was going to fail.
Dude.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that way you can just say, it was an electrical problem.
Right. Yeah. Anyways, I thought that was very interesting, I thought. And now Nikki's likely to ride the pneumatic valve Honda Dunnington. So
right. And for whatever reason, we've been speculating that the pneumatic valve Honda would suit Nikki's riding style better. And I'm not 100% sure I understand that. But
well,
I think
he probably like, you know, a little less traction control, a little more, you know, power, a little more. Revs, you know, where he can actually spin up
revs.
The rear tire or something. I don't know.
Yeah, but that's the. I'm wondering though, when that power finally kicks in, you're at the top end, and it's horsepower, not torque,
and all of that sort of thing.
Is that necessarily the classic Hayden riding style that we think of? Is the kicking it out and, you know, squaring off corners, etc. Is more horsepower gonna change that? And I don't know about anything about the torque, because we haven't heard much about that on the pneumatic valve engine versus the spring valves. I don't even know if that's something that's likely to change. You know, I'm not enough of a motor guy.
Yeah, neither am I, unfortunately. So anyway, so that was interesting, and I think that Pedrosa is very happy with the spring valve engine right now, but I also have,
of course, he is.
I mean, he's doing well on it, obviously, and when the pneumatic engine is finally, you know, ready for a full race, I think that and it actually does give him yet more of
advantage, edge.
I guess he doesn't consider it's going to give him that much edge right now, but. If it will, then he's going to be really hard to stop.
Well, the thing, you know, I mean, so far, the thing is the motorcycle, they might as well have called it like the RC212 DP or something like that, because, I mean, it was really designed around him.
And I actually wanted to talk a little bit about race planning, because so we had interesting things happen both in China and in Le Mans and in Mugello. Which was that Danny Pedrosa was very much in the fight in the beginning of the race and then started dropping off. And in China, he talked about how he was worried about the motor actually lasting the end of the race, the engine note changed. Remember, he was saying he was having trouble shifting.
Right.
And he was worried that he was not even going to make it to the finish line, so he'd rather take the second place. But then I started thinking, you know, I actually think that something else is going on, because it's more like we know what his strength is. His strength is being in the front with nobody in front of him and just putting in insane lap after lap after lap. And right. If you look at the Catalunya race, he was actually not that far ahead of Rossi at the end. He only won by like 2.5 seconds or something like that. Whereas at one point he was 8 seconds. Yeah, okay, hang on. Hear me out. So, at one point he was like 9 seconds ahead, and at the end he was 2.5. And sure, he's gonna make sure that he can finish the race. He's gonna let off a little bit because he knows he's got a huge lead. I mean, he was out of the straight when the guys were entering the straight at one point. So he was way ahead. However, right. I think what may be going on is that their whole strategy is based around the first part of the race, and they are pumping more fuel to the bike, and then they are switching to a more efficient fuel mapping at the end of the race, hoping that by that time Danny has built up a big lead, because we know he's not a great passer. And he's getting better, but he's still not the kind of passer like Rossi, who can start in ninth like he did and end up in second like he did at Catalunya.
Right.
That's also why they work very, very, very hard on Pedrosa's starts. I even saw this like back in 2006. He was always practicing starts much more than any of the other guys. Any session where he was out there, he was practicing starts. And I think they put a lot of technological aids also with the starts as well. His starts have been fantastic the entire year, flawless. He's one of the first guys in the first corner every single time.
Yes, even if he doesn't do all that well in pole, you can count on Pedrosa getting a good start. Yeah,
he's like, remember, I mean, Stoner had that reputation, and I think Stoner has a lot of that. A lot of that with Stoner is just pure talent, and I'm sure that it's the same thing with Danny. Both these guys are young; they have incredible reflexes. But I think that the bike is also set up to help with the start, whatever the technology they're allowed to use in terms of the start. And I think that they basically program their race around the first 75%, and then on the last 25%, it goes into efficient mode. Mm-hmm. And whereas Stoner likes to have his bike programmed for the end, and Rossi as well. Rossi likes to Rossi just wants to have an even setup so that he can play with the bike along the way. Anyway, it's a theory. I think that after this many races, this pattern keeps repeating. It's not that Michelin's going off or anything like that. Whether he's in the lead, whether he's second, or whether he's fourth, like he was at Le Mans, he faded in the last quarter to one third of the race.
Right,
and this could be one explanation. Anyway.
I think that's very, very reasonable, and it might explain a lot. And especially, well, your point about like Rossi wants even all the way along, and because
he wants to be able to adjust to whatever the situation is,
because he's a rider guy. He's the rider.
Right.
Not
you guys
the
were
bike,
talking
right?
about that last week, like the winner versus the rider mentality.
Yeah.
Rossi's definitely the rider mentality. Obviously, he wants to be prepared for anything, and he believes in himself to be able to rise up to whatever challenge might be happening on the track, whether it's like riders or weather or grip change because temperature changes or whatever. So
I agree.
Yeah, I'm sure he would rather have just do not change anything,
mm-hmm. Yeah, and I want to throw this in. We didn't mention this in our sort of pre-call. What are we going to talk about? But we got to talk a little bit about World Superbike at Nürburgring.
Let me wrap up in that case.
Let's continue with our MotoGP.
Okay.
And I just want to, because we're setting a deadline here, folks, on our call, because Jules and I tend to run long. And so I'm watching the clock tick down, and it's like, I've got to make sure that Jules is not right in the middle of an interesting discourse. I want a few minutes here. We've got to discuss World Superbike.
Right.
But let's continue.
So the other thing that I thought was interesting, worth noting, was back in Mugello in the 250 race. Did you get to watch it finally?
Yes.
So that incident with Simoncelli and
Barbara. I watched that like on the Tuesday or not too long after it actually occurred.
Okay,
speed time. Yeah,
right. So you know, he actually got kind of like a yellow card from the safety commission, which is headed by Rossi and Stoner and I think Hayden.
Yes.
Well, they basically told him, you know, I think I have read that. Hang on a second.
You mentioned it in a previous show, and it's basically be careful. But
I did. Okay, sorry. Yeah.
No. It's cool. It's worth mentioning again because
the interesting thing was how incredibly clean Simoncelli rode in Catalunya.
Yes, all of them. Barbera. It was a different rider, and Simoncelli and Batista were all. It was a bit of a different race. It was almost like you'd like expect. I mean, actually, and Simoncelli certainly can't be lumped into this category, but to a point, Barbera and Batista, like, you know, young kids that have been told off and now they're going to behave. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And Simoncelli is comparatively ancient. And so it's a little, you know, it's not like that, but it was a little bit like that, if you follow my meaning. I mean, just, you know, and granted, I mean, I think relooking at that whole thing, I don't think Simoncelli was crazy. You know, he in Mugello, he cut across, he was trying to basically break the draft and at the same time sort of just block.
He went to block him, definitely.
Right. But it's not like he meant to crash into him or something.
He's not anxious. He's like, I don't know, he's like 21 years old, I think.
I thought Simoncelli was one of the older ones.
I think you're thinking of somebody else. I think you're thinking of like Julian Simon or somebody like that. Or I don't know. But Marco Simoncelli was, yeah, he's like 21 years old. He's one of the young guys. I mean, he's the guy, you know, the lion hair. The lion.
Yeah. He's got the huge fro going on. Yeah. See, then that's another thing I have with 250s. I don't really know these guys. So I apologize. I thought Simoncelli was one of the older ones because there's a couple guys in 250s. And they need to go, but in any case, what I don't think, you know, it was a racing incident, and yes, he might have been a little aggressive,
but he certainly did stick his knee out, which is what Barbara said that Simoncelli stuck his knee out, and that's what caught the lever. But it's obvious from the video that's not what happened. He just touched the rear tire,
right? And I think too that and we discussed this earlier also is that Barbera might have been. This is actually in an email that we discussed this. I thought Barbera was almost cutting
taunting.
Insulting. It's like, you know, dude, hey, I'm just going to pass you when I want. And cutting it a little close, and that combined with Simoncelli cutting it a little close, next thing you know, Barbera is screwed.
Yeah.
My point, and I still stand behind that, is that this is such an easy fix. You just have some sort of guard over the brakes. And that was actually, again, going back to Cycle News, a subject of an editorial this week, is that, you know, how hard would this be?
They've been talking about this for years, actually.
Yes, exactly.
It came up. It's been longer than that incident in 2006. But remember Catalunya 2006, obviously, right. That horrible accident with Gibernau and Caparossi that took out like five riders. That started the debate all over again, and then they still haven't done anything about it. It's kind of weird.
No. Yeah, and the point of Henry, I believe it was Henry Ray Abrams' editorial in Cycle News, was that MotoGP bikes, you know, despite the fact that they're a prototype and everything, they have to look like the bike that you're selling because, you know, you want your racing efforts to drive your selling efforts. And the whole momentum or style fashion thing, what have you, you know, smaller and smaller fairings, tighter and this and that. And so if you sort of put a big old fairing that covers the brake handles, brake levers, then that's not necessarily that good. And he also pointed out, you know, some of the tragedies that occurred way back when with when they had the full fairings, like where this is the 50s and 60s. Yeah. And, you know, where the bikes were very, very streamlined and things. And there was a crash where, you know, the guy's hand was stuck and this is not a good thing. And so, you know, you have to balance safety with
realistically, you have to. This is a business. You have to balance safety with style and sales and everything else. But I stand behind that this is not a hard fix. It should not be a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, and they don't really need to make it big. Like, there doesn't need to be a fairing. It just needs to be a little bar in front of the brake lever.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. You know? Realistically, and that would be less exactly how much aerodynamic drag is that going to create and all of that, no more than the brake lever itself. Yeah. Yep. Yeah.
Or the rider's hand.
Exactly. Yeah.
Other news in MotoGP, obviously Seta Gibernau is testing with Ducati, which is very interesting. He actually was talking to Randy Mamola at Catalunya, and he said that he swears that he only went to Montmeló to just watch the race, but as a tourist. But then he was like going from garage to garage, and everybody was just really happy to see him, and he got talking to people, and apparently that's how that whole Ducati thing came down. It was they just had a conversation that weekend.
It's that sudden, really.
Well, I mean, I read the news, it could be BS, but
yeah. Well, I read that he was testing and all of that. I knew that, and I wasn't sure how long this had been in the works, because we haven't heard much from Sete. He's been very quiet.
Nothing.
You know, not that we want our guys that, you know, what do you want, retired racers or whatever, you know, they need to move on and leave the limelight for the new guys and this and that. So Sete was doing the right thing on that. But still, it's been a little bit, you know, what the hell happened to Sete Gibernau?
So Sete did test with him, and he put in a 153, I think, which is, you know, not too bad. He was about 2 seconds off of Guintoli, Elias Melandri's typical times at Catalunya. So,
which will put him firmly at the back of the grid.
Yeah. Yeah, but, you know, he's his first time on the bike in 2 years, so it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
He was very happy about it, and he has not ruled out any kind of return. He basically does not say anything either way. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine. He's 35 years old. He's had his thing. He's had a lot of injuries. But he does say he misses it. He misses, I'm sure all these guys miss it for the rest
of
their
lives.
Yeah.
I got to digress to the Sete thing.
Okay. More dancing?
No, more dancing. Okay. But one, why doesn't he go to World Superbike? Max Biaggi has had an enormous comeback, resurgence, epiphany. And Carlos Checa. You know, I mean, World Superbike, again, is, you know, the place where MotoGP races go to die. But I think that Sete could, because he didn't exactly end his career on the highest of notes.
No, no.
And I think, like, Biaggi is on track to, you know, he'll be able to ride off into the sunset with, you know, I've got this proud career behind me, et cetera, and it'll be a footnote that, you know, he didn't win championship and all of that. And it was because, you know, damn Rossi was there at the same time and this sort of thing, you know, but nobody pays attention to the footnotes. And, it'll just be remembered that he had a long illustrious career of racing. That's something that Sete should consider rather than trying to come back to MotoGP.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. I mean, I'm not sure if he has any interest in racing in anything other than MotoGP, but yeah.
Right. And that's the thing I'm not sure there's a seat for him either, but, saying that's what I think.
Well, hang on. So, you know, there was a guy during warm-up in Catalunya who didn't even finish warm-up. He was so depressed. There was a guy who rode during warm-up, and he was so... I mean, he didn't even
Melandri
finish the warm-up.
Didn't finish the warm-up?
Yeah.
I didn't hear that.
He pulled
that
up early. He was just like,
oh, wow.
Can't do this. And so I would not be absolutely surprised if Sete Gibernau sat in for Melandri for the last, say, you know, 3 or 4 races. I would not be surprised.
If he can get his times up, I mean, which, you know, you're right, he's had one ride, and I should be more charitable. So I suppose that's somewhat of a possibility, and that would be a tragedy, though, for Melandri.
It would be the worst kind of tragedy.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, and Melandri, I feel bad, because what's got to be going on inside Melandri's head, as Darren and I talked about last week, you know, the whole thing is confidence and everything, and Melandri has got to be so far down in the dumps right now.
He has not. I mean, you know, a couple of races ago, he said something like, "I keep getting on the bike, hoping, and it just keeps getting worse."
Yeah,
you know,
that's brutal. You know, yeah, and I mean, that's not a good way for the racer to be. The thing is if Melandri were to leave under those circumstances, where is he going to go?
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, he's had. Yeah, you guys were talking about that race in 2006 when, you know, he had that iconic image of going through the last corner at Australia, you know, hand waving and wheel spinning, and I mean, from that to where he is now, it's just amazing. And the thing is, but the problem is, you know, I heard he burned his bridges at Gresini.
I believe so.
Which
basically means he's burned his bridges with Honda.
Possibly, quite possibly. I was just going to say. And you know, where else is he going to go? I mean, Kawasaki. Maybe he's going to take Ant West's ride.
So probably there's a lot of guys lined up for that.
Exactly.
Seat.
There's tons of guys lining up. But, you know, he is a very talented rider, and he's also Italian, which will help.
Yes, this is true. I don't have right in front of me the numbers of Italians and Spaniards in the series this year, but we do know that Dorna has to keep that kind of stuff in mind, and it's strange. And Americans, frankly. Yep. I mean, you know.
The other news from MotoGP was Valentino Rossi saying he's now very, very close to signing a 2-year contract. And that he thinks he's going to carry on racing MotoGP until he's about 35. So that's cool.
Good. Yeah, that is good news. I hope he's got his four-wheel aspirations somewhat behind him.
Yeah.
With the whole, you know, I want to do it in both series and all that. I think the time for that has passed. It's just too different now, you know.
Yeah.
John Surtees will go down in the history books as the guy that did it. Right. And I think to see the guy that does a 2-wheel championship and a 4-wheel championship is not going to happen.
In those days, it was doable too. I mean, it's just like guys racing.
It was different.
Three different races in the same day: 125s, 350s, 500s. You know, Agostini doing that. You just can't do it anymore. Everything is so incredibly sophisticated and specialized. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Just like and in the four-wheel world, you know, the guys that used to hear about, they would race Indy at the same time that they were racing, like, you know, NASCAR and stuff. And, you know, we're talking 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, different cars and the Mario Andretti's and all of that, they were there at a special time, and that time is gone. And now it's a time of specialized, you know, these racers have been riding since they were, you know, 4 years old. And unless you get, you're not going to be able to compete with a four-wheeled guy, Kimi Räikkönen, that has been driving since he was 4 years old, because you're just not on the same playing field, you know.
Can I segue a little bit to
yes,
to
always
the four-wheel thing? So, you know, I watched my first full, you know, 2 hours of Formula One racing at Montreal.
The first time that you've watched an entire Formula One race, Jules?
Since 1998, Suzuka. Wow. When was it 98? Yeah, I think it was 98 when Mika Hakkinen won his championship because Schumacher started at the back of the grid and then raced through the field and totally wore out his tire and had a blowout. I don't know if you remember that, but that was the last time I watched a full Formula One race.
Okay, now I'll admit, occasionally I take a little nap in the middle of a Formula One race, but I often sort of somewhat come to consciousness enough to sort of pick up.
I've watched, you know, like the last few laps, and I did watch most of that ridiculous GP. Was it 2005? I think when they only had six cars on the grid.
Oh, the Indy? That was crap.
Because it was funny. But anyway, what I wanted to say was that. First of all, ITV, I watched the ITV broadcast. It was the most incredible, like, audiovisual experience I've ever had with a motorsport. I mean, I had my headphones on and I'm listening to this thing, and they have the it was like this weird scripted walk through the pits. Like the commentator is like going to all the drivers and he's asking to see if anybody's willing to talk to him, but they're all kind of like waving him off. They're all really stuck up, these guys. And then he runs into Bernie Ecclestone and and they have this really funny, very quick conversation, and the camera's following him the entire time, and all around you, like the way that the recording is of this ambient noise of engines and of the crowd, I was just blown away. I mean, I wish we had this kind of money in MotoGP. Obviously, this takes a lot of money to do this kind of broadcast. It was a single take, you know, like the commentator and the cameraman were walking through this field. The cameraman's got this really wide angle lens, and like you're just walking up to all the cars, and it gives you the idea of what it's like actually on a grid. It's not these kinds of broken moments and the same feed we see from everybody. It was amazing. I've never seen or heard anything like it, and it was
so amazing good,
amazing then? Great,
amazing great,
fantastic. Huh.
I have not watched an ITV feed of the Formula One races and all of that. And by the way, ITV is losing it and it's going to BBC next year. But in the United States here, we get it on speed. And I wish this is my wish, Make a Wish Foundation thing, that speed would do for MotoGP what they do for Formula One. Have. You know, and the thing is the speed broadcast team
of broadcasting, yeah, pretty much, yeah,
exactly. Have the pre-race show, have the whole thing going on. It's live, and you've got your tame speed announcers, which this is one American and three British guys, right? That does the speed commentary. So it's not like you have a whole bunch of Americans. We're not going to get Daryl Waltrip in there announcing MotoGP or some crap like that, right? You know, you just put in somebody like Dave Despain, right? That can control the whole thing. He's got the chops. He's got the experience. And then Randy Mamola would be perfect. So there's another American. And then, you know, a couple other British guys or Italians or what have you. And do for MotoGP what they do for Formula One. Show the whole pre-race show. Because like you say on the pre-race show where you've got who is the pit commentator now that I've lost it, but wandering up and down on ITV.
I have no idea what his name is. I just thought he was brilliant.
Some guy. Yeah. So the Speed TV, they have Peter Windsor. And actually, it pains me to watch Peter Windsor walk up and down the grid because I see those same things where he's like, if not actually being rejected for an interview, it's this fear of rejection. And it's sort of like this, oh, wow, let me see if Kimi Räikkönen will talk to me. You know, here, I've got a bottle of vodka to wave in front of him. Well, and I, you know.
The ITV guy was like the same way, but he was just really in control. Like, I don't know. It was good.
I don't know. We're digressing too much into Formula One, and it still pisses me off. Let me just say,
it was a very interesting race. And,
it is interesting.
And, of course, I watched it because I had a feeling that Kubica might take the win and Kubica won. And it was the first time that I've heard the Polish anthem in a worldwide motorsport event. So it was a very, you know, I'm Polish. So for me, that was extremely exciting. And I saw all the Polish flags flying in there. And like, it was a very, very positive experience. I actually watched also part of the Monaco race, the previous race. But not the entire thing because it was mostly in the, you know.
Mostly boring. I fell asleep through the Monaco one. And it's like my
that's,
little
that's
editorial.
That's the one race that I do watch, though. Like, Monaco I always
you
watch every
to.
Year.
You have to. Monaco is the race. Yeah. And I tried to stay awake, but the Sunday morning nap was just too tantalizing. but the you have to – with it's like I said in my little editorial last week – talking about the different kinds of passing and how with Formula One you do it's an acquired taste. Like so many of the good things in life, like beer, like wine, like I don't know, spicy Mexican food, whatever it is, you know, you have to sort of learn to like it. And once you learn to like it, you realize, wow, this is good. And Formula One to me is that way. But I'll admit, if they all of a sudden if they fired the whole speed team and put in, you know, Daryl Waltrip and I don't know who else, these Bubbas, I wouldn't watch it because it's not the racing. It's the whole experience for me.
Yeah.
It's the commentary. It's these guys obviously having a good time together. These three guys, you got Varsha and Hobbs and Matchett. And I mean, you can hear Hobbs cracking jokes and Matchett is just busting up. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, what is this? Some kind of game to make him laugh, you know? And I mean, that's what I would do in the booth. And, you know, screw up your coworker, right?
The MotoGP guys do that.
Yeah, exactly. The same interplay.
It's funny.
Yes.
It's fun.
How good they are. They work together. They're a team. They make even the most mundane of events very, very interesting. And it is. It's, and that's what does it for me on that. And I just, like I said, and this is one thing going back to AMA, and I know I said I would save this. This is one hope that I have for AMA, is that if the Daytona Motorsports Group becomes this big juggernaut of turning AMA into basically a three-ring circus, which is not a good thing, but at least on the bright side, you'll have a possibility of bringing up the awareness of the whole sport, and enough so that you'll get those sorts of that kind of interplay that will care about the winners and will watch their victory celebrations. And here's a big smoky burnout, you know, as Matt Mladen does it in front of, you know, the grandstand way at the back of the track and this and that sort of a thing that we don't see now. And then those are the things that I ardently hope for.
Right.
And especially, right, though, for MotoGP. But
Speaking of commentators, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, speaking of commentators, I was going to segue back to World Superbike before we run out of time.
Yes, yes. No, we've got plenty of time still.
Speaking of commentators, those guys are the worst. World Superbike.
Oh, I wanted to bring this
up. Wow. Wow. Talk about lack of energy.
But are you talking about specifically like Nürburgring, the last one we had?
Yeah.
Or in general?
Well, in general, it's been, you know, it depends who they have. Like, sometimes they get a decent guest on there.
Yes.
But Nürburgring, wow.
It was painful. It was awful.
Really
and
bad.
And that's the thing is okay, you've got World Superbike, the feed that we see here in the States, and this is the sort of international feed, and it is what you get on the World Superbike website. You've got Jonathan Green is the play-by-play. He's the main guy. He's the voice that you mostly hear, and mm-hmm. he's quite excitable as most of the time.
Yep.
But his color commentary guy, you know, the sort of the sidekick that's generally a former motorcycle racer and all that sort of thing, changes from week to week, and he'll go along. There'll be sometimes where, well, I think at the beginning of the season, it was Scott Smart a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yes.
And he got along real well with him. I thought they did well, but last at the Nürburgring, he had Steve Martin again.
Oh, Steve Martin.
And it was,
oh my God, he's the worst.
It was painful. It was awful. And it was a little bit like these two guys really don't like each other and they're just chit-chatting about this motorcycle race. And it was, it was awful.
It was such an incredibly interesting race, and the track
it was
so amazing. It was one of the coolest first corners I've ever seen in any racetrack. And nobody figured it out except Haga, actually. But
Haga,
let's really talk about this.
Nori Yokohaga. They call Nori Yokohaga Nitro Nori, and that's for a reason, right? He's not the guy that you watch doing the clockwork race lap after lap after lap,
right,
the same
right.
beautiful consistency, right?
Right.
At both of those races in the Nürburgring, probably because he broke his first bone.
Yeah.
And this guy's like in his 30s, a motorcycle racer.
Nasty crashes.
First time he broke his bone. Was that?
And he's had some nasty crashes, but
he's Nitro Nori. I mean, he's not Randy DePunier as far as being a bit of a crasher, but you know, he would be one of my first, not first, but I would pick him more often to crash than some of the other guys,
right?
Whatever. Nori Yokohaga ran the two most perfect clockwork races,
exactly,
line after line after line.
And he's the only one who figured out that first corner.
That first corner. And that first corner is exactly like the new turn four at Portland International Raceway, by the way, where it's
really?
Almost more than sharper than 90 degrees. So
is it downhill also?
No, not in Portland. Nothing
is
downhill.
You guys are pretty much flat, right?
It's dead flat. So yes, there was no downhill.
Because,
but the
I think
angle
that's what was throwing these guys off. I think it was because you're diving before. It's not like you're diving after you enter the corner. You're actually diving a little bit before the. It's a very very tricky corner.
It is. Well, then the thing is, though, is again pointing back to the whole passing thing. There are multiple lines that will work through that corner, But Troy was just, you could see every time.
Which one was Troy? Because both of them were like all over the place.
It was
Corser. Bayless? Oh, Corser, yeah.
And Bayless, actually.
So both of them were just, messing it up like crazy.
Yeah. And they'd run it a little bit wide. And most of the time it worked for him. But then for that one lap where it didn't work, Haga was there.
Yeah.
And bam. And he was. It was great to watch. I mean, and the rest of the racing, when they would show back in the a little further down the field, it was all very, very good stuff as far as – and I think that the same thing was catching out a lot of riders, that there would be some – bit of a cluster going on into that first corner.
Yeah, there was guys that drove all the way through it, you know, like went off the hill on the other side. I think there was Jakob Smirts went off the...
Yeah, he had
went so far past the breaking points that he just went over the hill and fell. And then, you know, and then some guys who were breaking way too early and then finding themselves like, oh, okay, I guess I better get back on the power. That is an amazing track, though. There was really fast S's that they have there, and like when especially in race two, when Corser and Haga were like on top of each other the entire race, and they were going through these S's so fast and so close together. It was just a beautiful race to watch, and I couldn't believe that the commentary was so lame.
Yeah,
I mean, I think I want to watch it again and just turn the sound off, even though I won't hear the bikes. And just enjoy the race, because I was getting frustrated. Like, you know,
race two was spectacular for the 1 and 2 yet with Troy Corser and Nori.
Yeah,
both on the Yamahas, and they had their own personal thing going on up front, and it was so fun to watch.
It was,
and I mean, it was. I was a little bit. Yeah, it was. You know, because I wanted Nori Ikuhaga to win. I like Nori.
Yeah, me too.
And I like Troy Corser too, but it's just, you know, it's just, oh, come on. You got to do this. One thing that I did notice, and this was actually from, you know, I noticed it, but also the commentators mentioned it, and it was Steve Martin. It said, there's a lot of waving going on in this race, and I thought that was hilarious. So,
yes.
Yes.
It was,
because most of the waving was with, it was not friendly waves. It was, you know, they were using all their fingers, but I think only just. So...
the other thing I want to mention is that, you know, Max Neukirchner wrote a good two races. He was third in both races. But I'm kind of annoyed with the Suzuki. I mentioned this once before, and like I'm just getting annoyed with when I talked to Jim Race two shows ago, and I asked him, "Do you really think Max Neukirchner is in the same class as guys like Haga, Bayless, Biaggi?" He said yes, and I have to say, after watching the Nürburgring, I just don't see it. I don't see him.
He's
being
got
the same
a lot
class.
Of growing to do. I think he's still acting like he's a rookie almost. Well, there's a lot of late braking mistakes and stuff like
Well, but then so Bayless was like,
yes, he did, and Bayless did not have a good
late
race
braking,
and yeah,
you know, Meister.
Yeah, and but that was also that's unusual for Bayless.
Very. Yeah. Although he's been pretty he was pretty sloppy at Miller too, actually. He likes to be sloppy, yeah. I think, a little bit. But
something's going on with the Ducati, I think, a little bit.
That's
too.
True. Yeah, I think so too. I think so too. But the thing about Max is that all his passing is either due to somebody making a mistake or on the straight. I have not yet seen him pass aggressively or purposefully the way these other guys do, like Haga. Corser. Corser.
He's not a setter upper like Corser. Corser is a huge setter upper.
He'll be setting up a corner like four apexes early. It's amazing.
Oh, easily. Yeah. You know? And he normally can make it stick. It's just that something about because Haga has the
like the close-in style.
Yeah,
he's a dogfighter.
It was a couple of years ago, and they actually mentioned something about the forks again this year. But a couple of years ago, I remember he had to have forks from the old R7. They had to like find the motorcycle in the museum and get the forks off of it and put them on the R1. And this was a couple 3 years ago, because he says these aren't working, you know. And so he's got quite a different setup. Him and Corsair are on, you know, very different motorcycles as far as suspension is concerned.
Interesting.
And yeah, and you can, well, you can see that in their lines.
That's what I was going to say. That explains a lot.
Yeah. And Noriyuki Haga is an interesting guy, and I love to watch his pit interviews or his podium interviews,
right?
Which he gets a lot of.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, no, World Superbike and World Supersport, which I still haven't seen the World Supersport race from Nürburgring. I'm not even sure if Speed has shown it yet. It's
probably next year sometime they'll show it.
Oh, it sucks. I hate Speed. But World Superbike's website, which is worldsbk.com, again, much like MotoGP.com was last year and is a little bit this year, good content saddled with a horrible interface.
Yeah.
But once you can sort it out and actually convince the web browser to do what you want, they have the whole race. You're allowed. You don't have to pay or anything like that. You can go to worldsbk.com and watch the whole race legally right there on the website. Which MotoGP.com you have to pay.
Right, but
and
you can't watch it live.
No, right. I don't think they have live. Actually, I haven't checked. But yeah, they used to have a thing where
they
you
do
pay
a live
for
thing,
World Superbike.
But not for North America, apparently. I think
is that
Speed,
what it is?
Yeah,
no.
Speed.
I love that. Yeah.
Blocked them or something.
Yeah.
Which is the whole funny considering that Speed doesn't show it live.
Yeah, doesn't it suck? And the BBC stuff. I love the way you can't see any of the BBC stuff if you don't, you know, and you got to go through proxies and all this kind of stuff. And it's more trouble than it's worth, frankly.
Right.
Because there are sites, which we've mentioned and you've mentioned, like racing-underground.com, where you can get some of this stuff. And which I'm surprised that site hasn't been shut down.
Yeah. But yet.
And we'll, yeah, sorry, I didn't say anything. But they, it's all some good racing this year. I mean, even AMA, I know you're not a huge AMA fan, but when you watch the AMA, especially the support classes, the Super Sport and the Formula Extreme and stuff, it's somewhat of a runaway at the front, especially in AMA Superbike. But when they do show finally the racing a little bit further down the field, it's some good stuff this year. It really is. Well, and Super Sport is very, very evenly matched. It's great to watch. You know, you got some real good names in there. And it's going to be a little sad if they gut it and make it into a sort of a, I don't know, you know, Mazda Miata spec racing series like that. What I think is going to happen.
Mm. And just to be clear. I mean, it's not that I dislike the series or something. I just don't have time for it.
And I understand. It's the series that I have the least amount of time for, too, and a lot of races go unwatched. My bitch is not with the riders, because I think actually they've got a lot of very, very talented guys that are fun to watch, not only on a how talented is this guy level, which is part of it, but also, you know, charisma, you know, I mean, like Jake Zemke is just seems like a fun guy. You know what I mean? I like to watch this guy.
Yeah.
But
yeah. He gives great.
The thing I hate about AMA is that half of the tracks that they race at are just crap and, just absolute garbage tracks like Fontucky and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just like, my God, why are you guys racing here? You know, this is, you might as well race in a parking lot. Put up some cones and let's have a motorcycle race.
Yeah.
And,
especially when you look at a race track like Nürburgring. I mean,
right. Exactly. A real race
track. What a cool race track.
Exactly. Like,
a little scary. That first corner. The last corner, actually. The last corner. Just before you enter the straight, when their heads are like, you know, inches from the railing, it's a little scary, but.
But this is why we paid these guys, not we, but this is why, you know, this is what they do. And I don't want to see guys dying. I don't want to see guys get hurt. But I sure as hell like to see pictures of guys like if you've seen pictures of the Macau GP. And scraping exactly. their shoulders on the wall.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, you know, this is and this is the stuff that I know that I am too afraid to do.
Yep. Want to do a quick Donington thing before we wrap up?
Sure.
There's a race, and
it's at Donington.
It's at Donington, and you know, so Rossi has an incredible record at Donington. He has been off the podium exactly once since 1998. 1998. Yep.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't have to check my little
And that was last year when they had the rain. So
I that's what are we thinking? Donington, of course, England in June. You know, is it going to rain? Is it not?
I haven't actually looked at the weather, but it doesn't really matter because it would be useless because it changes no matter what.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a 50-50 shot over the last several years. And when I went to Donington, I was lucky enough to actually go to Donington in 2004, and I was in Europe for 2 weeks, and that was the only day it rained. The only day. Most of the other days, it was like, you know, 78 degrees, which in London, when it's 78 degrees, old people are dying. And so, you know, it's like, what the hell?
Did you see the GP race there?
Yes. Oh, I did. Sweet. We got there. We missed the 125s because of the horrible traffic, but we got there and we watched we caught most of the 125 race and all the 250s and the MotoGP race. I only went Sunday. I didn't camp.
So 2004, that was Sete and Colin 1-2?
Yeah.
And Rossi 3rd.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm going to break out my book.
Classic.
This is bad. I was only at the race, and I have to look at the book to see who won and everything. But it was super exciting because that was my first MotoGP round that I ever went to. Cool. And I've always had a bit of a special affinity. How are what?
How were the hooligans?
They were so well restrained. I was a little disappointed. Mm. But you know, one thing that they have at Donington and probably at most European tracks is a whole lot better kind of swag and souvenirs and t-shirt designs, which I loved your comment that the fact that there were no t-shirts at World Superbike at Miller is barbaric. I love that. I said that is barbaric because what are you guys thinking? You know, hello, missed opportunity. Yep. No, Rossi won. I thought he won that race in 2004. It was Rossi, Edwards, Giovinco.
Uh-huh.
And Hayden came in fourth that year, 2004. And it was a wet race, wet-ish. But it's an interesting track. It's one of the older ones. It's classic. Like these were at one time roads, and now that it's a racetrack, that sort of a thing. And even with the relatively new car park, hairpin going on, which, what do they call those? The last hairpin, the Melbourne hairpin or whatever they call it.
I don't know, sorry.
Yeah. It's still a cool track. She got like the Craner curves and all that stuff, and it's really impressive to watch. So I'm looking forward to that race, and then Assen as well.
Who do you think is going to win this race? Come on.
I'm going with Rossi at Donington this year. Now, I don't think Pedrosa's got the chops, and because like you say, Rossi's only been off the podium one time. Going with Rossi. And I'll go out on a limb and I'm going to call like a trifecta, if you will, that I'll say the other two guys on the podium would be Pedrosa and Lorenzo.
Interesting. Yeah. I think Lorenzo is going to do well.
I think he will do well too. He's had time for recovery. He's hungry. He's going to show his stuff. And I only hope that he can restrain himself, you know, rein it in
a little bit.
Right, right. Just look, dude, don't crash on Friday. Yeah. You know, get out there, go on the race day. Yeah. And then I think Pedrosa is just pretty much on a tear this season as a whole, and he's always a safe bet. But I think that at Donington, you can say that Rossi's going to win.
I think that Rossi's going to have trouble because Bridgestone has trouble there. So we'll see.
Good point. Interesting. Good thought. So we'll have to see who does well on Ride On 2, which I'm continually disappointed by. I watch the race and I think, oh, yeah, I'm doing great. And I realized that I'd kind of screwed up, that I'd forgotten the picks that I made. And that's why I was talking about the Quinellas and the trifectas. It's like, look, I'm great at picking 1-2. It's just not necessarily in the right order. So it's kind of ticking me off. But all right. Okay. I think we are just about out of time. Yep. So. It's been fun. It's been real. I enjoyed talking to Jules, and we will have to do it again very, very soon.
Okay. I just want to just part with one word. Kubica.
Ah, Kubica. All right. We'll talk to you later, Jules.
All right, man. Thanks. Bye.
All right. That's going to do it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. As we said in the show, we got Donington coming up here very, very shortly, which if you download the show on Friday or Saturday, you're going to know that Donington is still coming up. If you waited till Monday, well, Donington was in the past. But in any event, Donington, one of my favorite races coming right up. And also one of the races that we have coming up is Laguna Seca in July on the weekend of, what, the 18th through the 20th. So I'm looking forward to that. Of course, I've got my tickets. Jules has his tickets. I'm going to bring down buddy Mike Reznor, that's a very casual MotoGP fan. And my son, who, as you all know, that you've been listening to the show, is in the Marines, and he's doing the Marine Corps translator thing. He's going to be learning Russian. And that Marine Corps school, the military school for the Defense Language Institute, is located in the town of Monterey, California. So, of course, he's going to be coming over there on the weekend and joining us, and it's going to be a great time. We'll have a hangout with my kid. And it's just, I'm really looking forward to that. So we got that coming up in a few weeks. And, of course, we'll be getting some on-site recordings of the sounds of MotoGP and some reactions from relatively newbie fans like my son and his friends and all that sort of stuff. So we're looking forward to that. And that's going to be happening very, very shortly. Let's see. That's going to do it for this episode number 133. Thank you very much for downloading the show. I do appreciate it. And I hope you liked the show. And until then, why don't we talk to you next week, which will be June 27th, episode number 124. And until then, keep the shiny side up and the rubber side down, and we'll talk to you later. Well, if you listened this far, you know that it's time for the disclaimer. And sometimes you might get tired of hearing these disclaimers. I sort of occasionally get sick of recording them or making up new, slightly entertaining versions, because I've kind of already gone through all the obvious ones, and now I'm just sort of trying to rummage around and find something, somehow, some way to say in a different way that MotoGPOD is produced by Bob Hayes and I am solely responsible for its content. MotoGP is a trademark of Dorner Sports SL, and the MotoGPOD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorner Sports SL. All the other trademarks are the property of their respective owners, and MotoGPOD is not affiliated with any of them.